Hello and hi, welcome to another Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks, and we are going to be talking Star Wars today, specifically Empire Strikes Back. My guest is Becca Harrison, who is a film critic, broadcaster, and an academic scholar on a lot of things. But she has a new book out from Bloomsbury in their BFI Film Classics line about The Empire Strikes Back. Welcome, Becca.
Hi, and thank you so much for having me.
You actually deep dive into a number of topics in and around Star Wars and for this book, Empire Strikes Back, and you saw some things that I never considered as being emblematic of representation and presentation in Empire Strikes Back. So, first off, why Empire Strikes Back?
Well, this is actually a case of the film choosing me rather than me picking the film, because I have been working for a couple of years now on a big academic research project about Star Wars and digital tech and representation and lots of different things. And the publisher, Bloomsbury, were just relaunching the BFI Film Classics series, which has been running for decades now. And it's quite a kind of established popular book series. And as part of the relaunch, they wanted to include The Empire Strikes Back as a new title because, you know, it's not been written about. It's actually the first ever sequel that they've included in the series. And so the editor there approached me and said, you're already writing this book on Star Wars and we'd love to, I think it was partly about kind of diversifying who gets to talk and write about Star Wars. So they kind of came to me and said, would you be interested in doing it and about this film? And it happens that I have a big soft spot for Rogue One, but Empire is like, you know, my childhood favorite Star Wars film. So I couldn't really say no. But yeah, it felt like it came to me and like absorbed me into it rather than the other way around.
Interesting. That's kind of the same way I feel. Rogue One became a instant favorite with me because it was the first Star Wars I had seen in decades that rekindled that sense of adventure and awe that I felt watching the first two movies as a teenager.
Yeah, I agree. I didn't go into it with very high expectations, because by that point we'd already had The Force Awakens, which was really fun, and like I had a huge sense of excitement about that film and I did really enjoy it, but it does tick all the Star Wars boxes and it hits all the same beats that we're used to and expect. So I think with Rogue One I was maybe less invested in it, and I was perhaps more ambivalent going into the cinema and then just sat there like not knowing what was going to happen next. And being completely awed, it was a...
Yeah, and I did almost the opposite. I went in with high expectations, but preparing myself mentally and emotionally to be disappointed, and I wasn't.
I feel like that's something that everyone has to do as a Star Wars fan. no matter who you are or which... what your kind of approach to these films is, I feel like everyone is always doing that with every single new film or TV show that comes out. There's always that like, am I going to hate this? And fortunately in that case, I was not disappointed.
So for this book, you have what, 6 chapters, 6 specific, I guess, chronological in nature, examinations of the production of Star Wars, actually the presentation of it in theaters, the fan reactions, the fan expectations, and a little bit of a background and examination of the implied representation on screen compared to the lack of toys matching that representation. How did you focus this book on those particular topics, and what was your approach to finding all these archival sources that you mentioned?
I mean, there is so much that I feel like I've had to leave out because the series is quite rigid in its formatting, so that you have to include something about the production, a kind of a reading or an analysis of the film, and then something about the responses or critic responses afterwards. So there is a kind of logic to it that you have to respond to. But there's just so much to say about this film. And I'm kind of amazed that there aren't more of these kinds of cultural histories of Star Wars already, because most people seem to have written biographies of George Lucas. Or, like, there's a lot of production history stuff out there. So that was the bit that I found the most daunting to approach, because people have really done their homework on that stuff. But the kind of histories of fan responses when the film actually came out in the 80s, and the cultural reception, and how critics responded, and how it ended up on different formats, and how we kind of think about it now, that hasn't been done so much. There's some really cool work out there on representation. So with that, I feel like I'm just offering my own perspective on it, which is, you know, nothing radical, but I think it's always good to have lots of voices offering different perspectives on things rather than just one or two who dominate a conversation. So it was really just a way of trying to organize tons and tons and tons of material. I actually, weirdly for a historian, I don't think chronologically. I tend to think quite thematically, and I'm quite scattered, and I like to kind of talk about a theme and then come back to it and circle around. But that doesn't always make for a very easy read. Mm-hmm. So just kind of having things linear and kind of progressing from right at the beginning when the film was first discussed by Lucas and the production team through to how we talk about it now, at least gives it some sense of narrative, I guess. Although I did think about it quite thematically, in terms of it being a film about disruption and deviance and all these kinds of, they're being tipped around a lot and everything's really unstable and they're being thrown around all over the place. So I used that to think about it. But the archival sources were all over the place. I was really lucky. I went to the Margaret Herrick Library, which is the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences archive in LA. And they had tons of really cool stuff, some of which were, you know, like marketing documents and kind of audience research that they were doing about the films before they came out. And it, you know, looking at the stuff and thinking, like, I'm not sure that many people have looked at these documents, and they probably sound a bit dry and boring. But that was really cool. And the British Film Institute also have some storyboards and artworks and things like that from the shoot in England, which are in a special archive, which you have to get, you know, special permission to go and visit. So again, I was really lucky to go and see that.
Now that sounds like an archaeological dig into the British archives, because it was the movie was filmed partially in England, and to have that firsthand access to stuff that was used then, it's kind of cool.
Yeah, we're just really, really lucky to have some of that stuff here. And for the BFI actually have quite a lot of holdings on Star Wars as a result of the films being shot here. The other thing that's really useful is that a lot of the production team who were working on the studio were British or were at least working in Britain, and a lot of them still live here. So it's actually quite, it's not that hard to be able to trace people to set up interviews. And again, this is just, this was kind of coincidence and luck that got me here. I ended up visiting the Norwegian location where they shot all the scenes in Hoth. So I went there. I mean, again, like just the timing of this could not have been like more down to the wire, but I went just before Europe went into lockdown this year. So I was out on a glacier in like this incredibly remote region of Norway, surrounded by snow, in a whiteout, interviewing the production team from The Empire Strikes Back, which was one of the coolest things I've ever done. But like getting that first, those firsthand accounts and that personal testimony from people who actually tend to not be interviewed that much and to be quite overlooked in the way that we put film histories together. So I spoke to Madeline Most, who was one of the, she was in the camera department, and Mike Brewster as well, who was in the camera department, and Peter McDonald, who was the second assistant director, but was like largely responsible for overseeing the team in Norway. And they had like amazing stories to tell, which I'm really glad that I got to sort of capture. Although, again, there's only, I only got like a tiny bit of space to allude to them in this book, but I'm hoping there will be more opportunities to share those later on.
Yeah, because you'd mentioned in the book that you talked to all these people, and I'm flipping through, waiting to get to the part where I can see some of the interview, and they're not there. I'm like, wait, there's more, and it's not here. What happened?
Yeah, I mean, I've got, there's a couple of, you know, a couple of comments and a couple of quotes from those interviews. I also, I mean, the book came out a month ago, so it was already really far through the production schedule at the point where I managed to do these interviews. So, you know, I had to kind of go back and plead with the editor, like, please let me put some of it in because it's really cool and it's really important. But, you know, it was at quite a late stage. And yeah, there's just not that enough room in this book to do justice to all the incredible stuff that they were talking about. So, yeah, so my plan is to publish them somewhere else or to include them in the next book later on.
Awesome.
As
long as we get to see them, that works for me. Talk about how all of the technical side and the emotional side and the academic examination side, how that came together, how that broke down for you in creating this narrative. Because you said that BFI has a very strict structure for these film classics analyses.
Yeah, so I wanted to approach this in a slightly different way to the way that I have been kind of trained to write as an academic, which is quite different to the way that you tend to write as a journalist or at least as a film critic, where there's more space for you within the writing. But for me, I feel like often academic writing, and this is not to disparage anyone else that does it, but it often for me ends up feeling a bit dry and like it's lacking in, it can lack self-reflection. And I think you can sort of see yourself as being completely distant from the thing that you're analyzing or talking about, when actually you're not, as soon as you're starting to realize that you're quite close to it. And other people in academia and who write this kind of scholarship have talked about being like ACCA fans, where you're both an academic and a fan of the thing that you're writing about. So people have kind of theorized this quite a lot. But I just wanted to get past all of that and to say, like, this is who I am, and this is what my relationship with this film is like. And like, that's what I'm going to talk to you about. I'm not going to pretend that I'm being objective or that I'm neutral or that I don't exist in this writing. Like, actually, it's me and my subjectivity and my emotional engagement with the film, which is underpinning everything that I have to say about it. So I kind of wanted that to be transparent. And also because it felt quite politically important to do that, because again, like, I don't want to erase the work by marginalized people that has been done on Star Wars. And, you know, there are tons of people writing blogs and various different websites and who run podcasts who are Black, of colour, queer, women, lots of different intersections of identity going on. But when it comes to academic writing in particular, and in like kind of mainstream spaces like BFI Film Classic Series, these things tend to be written by white men, which is not to say that white men don't get to have a voice and don't have interesting things to say about Star Wars. But I feel like in challenging that, being really open about saying, like, again, like, this is who I am and this is how I am not that, is helpful, I hope, in actually saying, like, you know, first of all, some people don't want to listen to me saying things about Star Wars because I'm a woman, and that's fine. But with this book, I'm trying to say, like, hold my hand, come on this journey with me. I'm not telling you you're wrong. I'm not telling you that my opinion is more important than yours. I just want you to spend a bit of time with me and see this film from my perspective. But I also, what I really hope it does is speak to people who are equally or more marginalized than me in lots of different ways. And that it also says to publishers and says to editors, there are different ways of doing this. And actually you can engage with these big blockbuster films, with the science fiction genre, with fantasy, action, Star Wars, all of which we tend to kind of think of in this quite masculinized way. And actually other people have really, really cool stuff to say about this. And I hope that I hope it's like a tiny step towards changing the shape of what these discussions look like, just based on who gets asked to write them.
In your research, was there a particular voice or a particular anecdote or bit of history that surprised you that you hadn't known before?
Yeah, actually, there is more of this interview in the book, actually. Again, although there's like tons of this material I didn't get to use, I interviewed Terry Hardin, who was a big Star Wars super fan back in the late 70s and 80s. And she was talking to me as a woman with Black heritage who was on the front page of every newspaper in LA, queuing outside the Egyptian theater for like 3 days. She was at the front of the queue. She was interviewed multiple times on the news. You know, every time I've looked at any news report, there's her picture again. And so it was really great to speak to her about what her experience of like queuing up for the film was and being interviewed and how people were responding to her in the press. But also like to realize that it was a woman at the front of that queue. And actually when I started to look through the newspapers and like really looked in detail at all of those reports, they were often saying, we interviewed this group of people, or we interviewed that group of people, or, you know, the film has now opened and these are the audience members that we interviewed on the way in or the way out. There are so many women's names. And it's so many women being interviewed. And often it's like, you know, here is mother of two, Jessica, who has written a note to let her kids skip school so that she can go to see Star Wars and take them with her. Or, you know, it's women who are computer scientists, or I think there's a woman priest in there. And I was really, really surprised by this, because even though I know that women have always liked Star Wars, and even though I think most people will accept that women have always been in the Star Wars fandom, it was actually just a surprise to me to see how prominent they were in those narratives. And it was just like ordinary. I feel like now, weirdly, in 2020, you know, if there were a huge bunch of women queuing outside a cinema to see Star Wars, someone would frame that as being like, oh, look, women also like Star Wars. Who knew? And it would be something that we would have to like comment on and like, huh, didn't see that coming. Whereas then it was just like, yeah, and so that was really surprising to me. I was pleasantly surprised, but yet quite shocked by it.
Cool. So what other interesting tidbits do you think you might eventually get a chance to publish someplace else? Because like I said, the list here of acknowledgments and notes and footnotes is wonderful, because there are references in here of like, oh, I may have to go check that. No, I have to check that out. No, wait, I have to check that out too. Holy cow, this is homework.
Yeah, I mean, there's just so much material. And it's one of those things where you're like, you know that you've missed stuff because there's so much. And so I'm actually looking forward to other people coming along and filling in the gaps and like coming at it from a different angle. So I wrote something since sending this off to the publisher. I actually wrote something that did fill in some of the gaps, which was about the kind of queer history of the film, which I sort of allude to a bit for about 300 words maybe in the middle of the book, but I did not get the chance to really think about. So I was looking at the productions that the filmmakers had been working on before they came to The Empire Strikes Back. And it was this big, long list of like really, really camp, like melodrama fashion films. So Billy Dee Williams had been working on Mahogany. Irving Kirshner, the director, had been working on The Eyes of Laura Mars. Peter Shusitsky, whose name I can never say right, he was the cinematographer and had come off the back of the Ken Russell film Listomania and the Rocky Horror Picture Show. So there was just this kind of like catalogue of like the campest films from the 70s that you could possibly imagine. And then, like, when I started watching those and then looking back at The Empire Strikes Back, I'm like, this film, like The Empire Strikes Back is like so rooted in that camp, queer, subversive sensibility. And that just made me see the film in a completely different way. So, I mean, I've kind of done a bit of piecing together of that work and written something short on it. But yeah, I think mostly it's the interviews that I really want to go back to and spend more time with. Like Terry's story is really, really interesting because she was, as a super fan, I think she saw the first Star Wars film, I think 400 times in cinemas. It was a huge amount. And she ended up from this kind of falling into this science fiction fantasy adventure, what ended up doing puppeteering for Jim Henson and Imagineering for Disney. So it's like, that's a really great story in terms of how these films have actually impacted someone's whole life and career. And I think that we tend to think of fandom and like being a super fan as something that's like a bit frowned upon, or it's a kind of taboo thing, or people raise eyebrows. But there was like this really clear reason and rationale for someone being that invested in it. And the same with the interviews with filmmakers. And I want to go back and interview more people who were involved in the production. Someone who's really high up on my list is Pamela Mann, who was the only woman on location in Norway for the whole shoot. And she was the continuity girl, and apparently was quite a formidable person and a force to be reckoned with, which I guess you would have to be if you were surrounded by men in the middle of nowhere on a glacier. But the kind of first-hand accounts of just how tough that shoot was, the kinds of things that they were doing on a daily basis just to get a few seconds of footage in, I think it was one of the worst winters that they'd ever had in Finse at that point. It was, you know, they were shooting in blizzards, in whiteouts, people were getting frostbite. Yeah, it sounded like a nightmare shoot. So digging down more into that, I think, would be really cool.
Well, I definitely want to hear or read the interviews that you did, and hopefully you get to publish those someplace where we can all see them. Where can people find you online to keep track of when you do get these stories out there? Because I think there's so many more levels that we can go to, not not just Star Wars as a whole, but the reactions, the changing reactions to these movies over time. I mean, these movies are 40 years old now, and the sequels and the prequels have their own impact on the original saga that a lot of fans are still coming to terms with. And I have my own issues with the sequels, but
Don't we
who
all?
doesn't?
Yeah, so I so thinking about that, like I teach students at the University of Glasgow, and one thing that I've noticed over and over again is that people who are like 18 or 19 now have a completely different relationship to the prequels than I do, and they are so much more revered and loved, and they have so much affection for them in a way that I don't. So that's really interesting to me to just see how that you, it's already changing, like it's already changed. Those people are going to be film critics in 5 years' time, and they're going to write about the prequels really differently to how we did. But yeah, in terms of finding me online, I am mostly on Twitter. I probably spend too much time on Twitter, where I am Becca E. Harrison. So you can quite easily find me there, and I'm often posting links to Star Wars work that I'm doing.
Awesome. I'll have a link to
Awesome.
that. And
Yeah.
for the record, I like Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back just about equally. Rogue One is like a hair in between, somewhere between Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back. I liked The Force Awakens quite a bit. I don't like how the promise of the story that was set up in that first movie was totally obliterated in the next two. And I will not talk about Rise of Skywalker because that gets me angry, and that's just not good for anybody. But I also loved Phantom Menace because it was a Machiavellian power play, played to perfection, and then kind of wasted in Clones and Revenge of the Sith. I'm like, really, guys? Really?
Yeah, I think of the three of them, I think The Phantom Menace probably is my favorite. But then I was quite young when I saw that. And so again, it's got like a kind of childhood nostalgia thing for me. And I think like I would, after seeing it, I think we saw it a couple of times at the cinema, and my sisters and I would all like do Annie quotes all the time and like chase each other around as if we were pod racing. So yeah, I do like that one. Yeah, the sequels, I mean, I weirdly thought that The Rise of Skywalker had some redeeming features, but that's probably for another conversation. And it does, yeah, I think it's we're still close to it. So everyone gets quite passionate about that.
Cool. So we will have links to your Twitter feed and where people can buy Empire Strikes Back. You said Bloomsbury is having a holiday sale, so they if people buy this book directly from Bloomsbury, it's 30% off, 25% off.
Yeah, it's 30% off, which I think applies to the US shop as well as the UK one.
Awesome. Well, I will dig up links for that and make sure people head to the right place to get themselves a copy of this book. Becca, thank you so much for sharing your insights and your time today.
No problem. It's been lovely. Thank you.
And we'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi right after this.
Escape Pod is your destination for the best in modern short science fiction. Our intrepid crew of editors and hosts will bring you fun, thought-provoking in-flight entertainment every week as the pod careens around the multiverse. In the mood for a classic? We've got Anson Mount, also known as Captain Christopher Pike, reading Theodore Sturgeon. Want something a little more up-to-date? Jennifer R. Donahue's Surveillance Fatigue has you covered. In every sense. From classic space opera to intimate character drama. From heroic alien pets waiting for their families to herds of Einsteins and the benevolent conspiracy they're hatching, Escape Pod has it all. Take a ride with us at escapepod.org and buckle up because it's story time.
And yeah, we could talk all day about Star Wars, couldn't we? I think there's so much to talk about in light of the stories that have come out about the prequel saga, about the sequel saga, and how that affects the story overall. Yeah, I have opinions about how some parts of the story presented in those movies goes. I would like to know why certain key scenes that were in some of the novelizations weren't in the movies. They were added to improve the story. Why weren't they also added in the movie, or at least alluded to? I should say movies. I know of three instances. One in Rogue One, two in Rogue One, actually. And possibly another in Empire Strikes Back, who knows? Either way, there are so many deep dives that could be done on all of these movies. Because we love them so much, we look for inconsistencies. We nitpick on flaws. We just had that nitpicking discussion featuring other authors who have written for Star Wars or around Star Wars. And this book is an excellent addition to your Star Wars collection if you are a fan of the story behind the story. A lot of research, a lot of interviews, a lot of perspectives I hadn't thought too much about. And Becca definitely has some insights onto the stories around some of those other perspectives, and you should go check this book out. We mentioned in the interview, Bloomsbury now has their BFI Film Classics books on sale. If you buy directly from Bloomsbury's site, you can get this book and many others 30% off. And I have a print copy that will be given away. Not sure if you'll get it in time for Christmas, but you'll definitely have it in time for New Year's. Keep an eye out on the website for contest details about that. But what are your thoughts on the academic approach to examining our favorite genre topics? Because remember, they had several years of academic conferences just about Buffy, and there was one on Babylon 5 as well. So this is a wide and varied field of study that I kind of wish was around when I was in college. So if you have any questions or comments on that or anything else, feel free to call in. The number is 602-635-6976. Or shoot me an email, summer@sliceofscifi.com. You can listen to Slice of Sci-Fi on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, TuneIn, Player FM, and iHeartRadio Podcasts. And if you're listening on either Apple or Stitcher, please leave us a review. Your reviews, your commentary helps boost the profile of this podcast and lets other people know they should check it out for themselves, because you're enjoying it. Why shouldn't they? You can follow us on Twitter @SliceOfSciFi. You can also follow us on YouTube, youtube.com/SliceOfSciFi. Come on by, see some of the videos, including that Star Wars Nitpicking is Love episode I mentioned. And of course, you can come by the website, sliceofscifi.com. Come on by, check out our other interviews, our other reviews, articles. Leave a comment, start a conversation. That's what we're here for. I'd like to thank everyone who is currently helping to support this show and all the other podcasts and websites in the Slice of Sci-Fi universe. Your pledges through Patreon and donations through PayPal really do help keep the lights on around here. If you'd like to add your support, the place to go is patreon.com/sliceofsci-fi. Or if a monthly pledge is not something you can commit to at the time, but you still want to help out, the link to use is paypal.me/sci-fi-summer. And remember, people who are patrons are eligible to be selected. One winner per month gets the chance to choose from the many books and Blu-rays and DVDs and even a few 4K movie selections here. That's my gift back to you for helping keeping the show going. The many review items I get here are taking up space that I need to free up. And for me, there's no better way of expressing my gratitude to your support than by giving you first dibs on all this cool stuff. So again, my gratitude, my heartfelt thanks to all of you who are helping to keep all of this online. And that'll do it for this episode. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi next week. Take care.